Today is Wednesday, April 26, 2006. This is Susan Resnick. I'm in the lovely home of Dr. Brage Golding in Carlsbad, California. Dr. Golding was president of SDSU from 1972 to 1977. This interview is part of the SDSU Oral History Project, and it's supported by a John and Jane Adams mini-grant. Good afternoon, Dr. Golding.
Good afternoon, Susan.
Dr. Golding, before we talk about your years as president of San Diego State University, I'd like to find out about the years before, when you were growing up. Tell me where you were born, and tell me a little about your parents and family.
Okay. I was born in Chicago. I don't think I need to name the state. And grew up there. Mm-hmm. It was a very nice time at that time. And I went to Oak Park and River Forest High School, which is one of the best high schools in the country, for which I was very grateful, even if I had to walk 2 miles to school. No heavy snow, though, at the time. That's the closest I could get to Abraham Lincoln. When I graduated from high school, after much checking, I ended up going to Purdue University as an undergraduate student and majored in chemical engineering. I was fascinated with chemistry.
Did that start in high school?
Yes.
Tell me about that. Were there teachers who inspired you?
Yes. I had a medium-aged teacher named Ray Soliday. And he ran the course and the laboratory. And I knew more about chemistry than any other student at the time in the course, because I had spent at least 2 years going to the John Cuerrier Library in downtown Chicago on weekends, taking out books on chemistry. And I knew quite a bit of chemistry by the time I went to college. In fact, as a freshman in college, I helped the junior students in their chemistry course.
That's wonderful.
Well.
Was anyone in your family a scientist?
Not at all.
Interesting.
I have a twin brother. And I've been interested all my life in technical things, chemistry, mathematics, you name it, I have an interest in it. My twin brother, has no interest in that at all.
What is his name?
Stanton, normally known as Bud.
Okay.
And his interests were in music and in literature and opera and things like that. We were polar opposites.
Did you have any other siblings?
I had one sister. He did too. Do you mind a little humor?
No, I love it.
Okay. And she was 3 years younger than we were.
And what? And her name?
Doris. In fact, she's here in town right now.
Well, that's
she came
nice.
For the winter season, and she's leaving this weekend to go back home to Chicago.
What were your parents' names?
My father's name was Leon, and my mother's name was Viola. She came as a Southern Belle up to Chicago from Louisville, Kentucky. Louisville. My father was born in Chicago.
Nice.
And so he'd been there a long time. Anyway, after my brother and I were born, my parents moved to Oak Park, a suburb of Chicago, and they bought a duplex house. We lived downstairs and my grandparents lived upstairs. We usually had two meals.
that was your father's parents that were upstairs.
Yes.
Yes.
And my father had two sisters and a brother. And we saw them very frequently, obviously. If we weren't full of downstairs food, we would have went upstairs and had upstairs food.
And was it different kind of food, or?
No, they were both good cooks. My mother and my grandmother.
Oh, that's nice.
And so we got plenty to eat. I'm mindful of one day when they were out of food and they were out of the house. And I was looking for something to eat, and I finally did find something to eat downstairs. And when the folks came home, my mother looked at what I was eating and shrieked. I was eating dog food. There was a box of dog biscuits. And it was one of the better meals I had.
Well, it's fun to look back at memories from those times. Well, did you have friends in the neighborhood as well?
At that time? No. Because we just moved there.
I see.
And we didn't stay there very long.
I see.
Because we moved a couple of years later, or less, I don't remember the exact times, to another part of Oak Park.
So, when you moved, where did you move? Another part of Oak Park?
Yes. Oak Park was a village. It had 60,000 people in it. So it was kind of an enclave in the midst of more places around Oak Park. Kind of like the place I live in now. Carlsbad, it's a village.
Yes.
And same idea. I grew up in Oak Park and went to Oak Park and River Forest Township High School, which some people may recognize. It's a very good school, as I mentioned earlier.
Right. And then you said after high school...
After high school, I decided to go to Purdue University because I wanted to take chemistry, which was my favorite subject. So I enrolled in chemical engineering and completed 4 interesting years there.
Were there any professors there that you really liked or who influenced you?
Yes, there were several. One was my chemistry professor at the freshman age, freshman chemistry. Partly because he let me go at my pace, and I had a background mm-hmm. already on my own self-study.
Mm-hmm.
And that was good. And the chemistry professor that I told you about, Ray Soliday.
Mm-hmm.
And I lived in a dormitory there, had my own private room, which was unknown of today. And maid service.
Wow.
Things were different then.
And then what happened after the 4 years?
I have to tell you an anecdote.
Please do. That's good.
Between my junior and senior years, I had a boyfriend who lived in a room next to mine. And we were very close. And that summer, between our junior and senior years, my mother got tired of having us hanging around the house where we were, our house. He lived in Buffalo, New York, but he was out visiting me. And she said, "You boys get out of here. You're a pain in the neck.
Yeah.
Take a trip somewhere," which was surprising for young boys. So I borrowed a brand new car from my uncle, my father's brother, and he loaned it to us, and off we took and headed east from Chicago, just to see what we could see.
Mm-hmm.
We hadn't been very far, and we headed east and went to Kenmore, which is a suburb of
Which state were you in? Do you remember?
New York.
New York, uh-huh.
No, it's the city. I just told you.
Rochester?
No. Buffalo.
Buffalo, sorry.
Yeah. And they were out on the Niagara River. They had a summer cottage. And we went swimming and surfing, getting pretty close to the falls, but not too close. And after a while, his mother said, "You boys are a pain in the neck. Go somewhere." So we got in the car again, loaded up, and started traveling with a purpose in mind. We drove from city to city that had a university.
Oh, my.
Because we wanted to see what the other universities were like.
Oh, that's terrific.
And we finally ended up at a small university in... I know it.
Was it in the Midwest or... but anyway...
Anyway, I know the name of the university. I was trying to think of the town. I don't know. It was called MIT.
Oh.
What's the name?
Oh, that's in Cambridge, Massachusetts.
Cambridge.
Right.
It was very small then. I was serious.
Mm-hmm.
Now it's big.
Yes.
But it was quite small then. And it was August. And school was not in session. And there were practically no one around the university. But the front door was open. So we walked in. And on the left there, I can see it like yesterday.
Mm-hmm.
There was the registrar's office. And we walked in there, and there was an old man sitting back behind the counter reading something. I don't remember, of course. And he looked up at us, and we said, "Good afternoon," and so forth. And he said, "Good afternoon, what do you boys want?" And I said, "Could we each have a copy of your catalog, please? We're collecting catalogs." And he said, "Sure." And he got up and walked behind to the counter and reached behind and gave us each a catalog. And then he said, "Where are you boys from?" And I drew myself up to my 6'10" height and said very proudly, "We're from Purdue University." And he looked up in the air over my head. And after a moment or two, he said, "Oh, yes," he said, "that's in the Midwest, isn't it?" And I was crushed.
Yeah.
I'll never forget that.
Mm. Mm. That is memorable.
I'll never forget. Anyway, we drove around, came back eventually, and I drove home. On the way home, I had an automobile accident.
Oh, what happened?
I was going on a country road in Michigan on the way home to Chicago, and I came up over a hill, and another car was coming the other way toward me, coming up the hill on the other side.
Uh-huh.
And we met. He was in the middle of the road. Of course, it wasn't my fault. And he was a farmer and his wife.
Mm-hmm.
Unfortunately, he had 3 cartons of eggs in the back seat. I shall not go into that further.
Oh, wow.
Oh. How are you doing? The reason I mention this event is that the police were there. This was out in the country. No one was around. And in 5 minutes, there was a crowd around and a policeman there. And he could see that I had not been at fault. And he took me to the train station in some town, Michigan, I don't remember where, and put me on the train and called my folks and said I'd be home in an hour. And, of course, they were very worried.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I mention this for a reason. I did get home. I was kind of shaken up, and I was immediately put to bed and examined by a doctor they called, and all that. I was all right. And about an hour later, the doorbell rang at the house, And my folks went to the door, and it was a girl. And she said, "My cousin is a classmate of Brazier's. And I wanted to see him, see who he was and everything." And they explained, my folks, that I was in bed. And so she said, "That's all right." So she came up and talked to me for a while. And I'll cut the story short by saying that was my wife-to-be.
Oh, that's lovely. And her name was Hinda?
Hinda. Hinda Faye.
That's a lovely beginning.
I thought it had a point to it.
It does. And so, from that point on, did you and Hinda begin to see each other?
Very frequently. And it was good.
That's lovely. That's just a lovely story. And how old were you both at the time?
16.
Mm-hmm. It's terrific. Really nice. Good story.
You want another one?
Sure.
Okay, I got stories. You'll like this one too. That summer I went to summer school at Illinois Institute of Technology to take one course in mathematics because I was half a year ahead and I wanted to get the whole year ahead so I could start out straight again. So I went downtown in Chicago to the IIT and I took this math course.
And you were taking this course to get ahead?
Yes. Well, I was an odd semester then.
Right.
One semester I took.
Right.
That's all I needed. Because I had had the freshman year. This was the first semester of the sophomore year.
Right.
So I took the second semester there. And there were over 25 students in the class. And it was interesting. This is about me, which I regret, but it tells a story.
Mm-hmm.
I was the only one that got a passing grade in the whole class.
Really?
Mm-hmm. And it turned out that all the other students were taking it for the second time.
Oh, my.
So the professor got a hold of me after class and said, "How many times have you taken this course?" And I said, "I've never taken it." And he couldn't believe me.
Mm-hmm.
My feeling was that was my introduction to higher education.
I think that's a marvelous introduction.
These things happen. You get lots of things happening.
Well, it's very interesting to me that you took that cross-country trip going to different universities. That's special.
Yeah, it is. I don't know anyone else that's done it, but I don't know.
But, you know, in terms of how your path evolved, I think that's very interesting, and this as well. So, let's go on with as you proceeded in school.
Well, I'd like to tell you something about my brother and sister.
I would like that.
I've already mentioned the fact that my twin brother was interested in the fine arts,
yes,
so to speak, and my sister, who was, what I said, 3 years behind us.
Mm-hmm.
She went to the University of Michigan. He went to DePaul in Indiana. Not DePaul, in Chicago.
Okay.
And she majored in fine arts, too. Anyway, my father was a practitioner of a court reporter.
Okay.
Most people don't know what a court reporter is. You would know. And the difference is that he wrote shorthand. There's no shorthand court reporters anymore. And the interesting thing about that is he was office boy for a shorthand reporter in Chicago first, with his first job. And he learned his boss's shorthand. Hmm. And this was before standard shorthand, which is written now.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, I'm the only living person, I think, who knows the shorthand now.
Huh. Very interesting.
No one can read it except me.
Amazing.
Yeah, there are a few interesting things that happened in my life. I worked in his office in the summertime next year,
mm-hmm.
and he said, "While you're here shaving cylinders on a dictaphone machine," mm-hmm. this was long gone now, that they recorded on, no electronic devices.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, "While you're here wasting your time here," he said, "you might as well learn typing and shorthand."
Mm-hmm.
And so I started doing both. It turns out that I wasn't as interested in typing as I was in shorthand.
Mm.
And so I learned this lettered system, as it was called. That was his boss's name. And
that's very interesting.
Spent a great deal writing shorthand. And it had proved eventually to be very valuable because I sat in classes taking notes,
mm-hmm.
and no one else could do it.
Yeah. Oh, it's great. And your brother didn't work in the summer in the same place?
No. It was a very interesting time. Mm-hmm. I did do some typing, but not much. It was the shorthand that
tricked
me.
That's fascinating. Huh.
And I can still write it, although not very fast anymore. I have a little notebook when I was in college in my private room.
Mm-hmm.
I had a radio, of course, a big one. They didn't have little transistor radios then. And you won't remember this, I don't think, but every Saturday night there's a program on the radio. I can't remember what it's called. I'll think of it eventually. But it was Your Hit Parade.
Sure.
You remember that?
Sure.
And I used to sit there and copy down the words of the songs.
Oh, my.
And I have a notebook here. I'll show you later, which dated 1937.
Oh, my.
That you don't remember.
That I don't remember. But I do remember on the program Your Hit Parade. And all of that music is so marvelous.
No, it's great.
Great music.
I have it here, and I can still read it.
That's terrific.
And no one else can read it. But what I really wanted to tell you was the fact that where the shorthand came from.
Where?
Charles Dickens.
Really?
You may know of him.
I do know of him, but I didn't know his connection to shorthand.
He was a reporter in Wales.
Mm-hmm.
And Mr. Leonard learned it from him. He came from there.
Oh, interesting.
They're long gone now, including my father.
Yeah.
It started with Dickens and went to Leonard and went to my father, and I got it. And they're all dead.
Yeah.
And I don't think there's anyone in England now that writes it or knows it. Unless he's older than I am. And that's doubtful.
Ooh.
Isn't that something?
That is really interesting.
When I die...
You have to meet like the Rosetta Stone.
That's right. Well, Leonard and I wrote a little book of shorthand. So I have that now.
Oh.
But I don't know. That's another story.
Okay.
I can't help it. You can cut out half of this. My father was the best shorthand reporter in Chicago.
Mm.
In fact, one of the best in the country.
Mm-hmm.
He used to sit at home by the radio and taking stuff down in shorthand, anything, just to keep in practice. Because he was in court and he had to get everybody's stuff on different pages and
mm-hmm.
everything. It's good work.
Yeah.
He said, although I never watched him, he said he could do two people talking at once. And I don't know, I never saw him do it. That he said he could. Anyway, he was good.
Well, that's amazing. And it's interesting.
interesting and unusual.
This is very interesting. One of those summers when I was in the Army later on, he was deputized to go to Pearl Harbor, not as a court reporter, because he was the one that was recommended. The trials of Kimmel and Short, the admiral and the general, who were being court-martialed for what happened at Pearl Harbor. But it so happens that my father did not like to write English. No problem. I mean, he's prestigious because he knew shorthand. So he says, if I write letters to you in shorthand, you can read them. I said, I don't know. It's hard to read another person's shorthand because every little squiggle is different. He says, well, let's try it. So he wrote me a long letter in shorthand, and it took me a long time, but I read it. And I would write him back in shorthand. And he says he could read it easily, but he said I was a lousy shorthand writer. And I said, well, I'm just starting. One day, a man showed up at my door in Lawton, Oklahoma, where I was at the time as a lieutenant. He showed up at my house. And he said, are you Brig Golding? And I said, yes, why? He said, I want to interview you. And I said, why? And he took this envelope out of his pocket and said, is this yours? And I said, yes. He said, what does it say? And I looked at him and I said, why? He said, I'm from the intelligence office of the Army. And no one can read it. My father had put in the upper left-hand corner in shorthand, in case of loss or something, address it to so-and-so, all in shorthand. And they didn't know what it was. From Pearl Harbor during the war.
Well, that's a marvelous story. That's fascinating. It really is.
Well, I've got a lot of those, you see. You can make it interesting without telling anything about me.
No, well, it's all about you, because it's an interesting journey as you proceeded. Now, you mentioned that you were in the Army. Tell me about what that was like, how you went from college into the Army. Tell me about that.
I have to retrace a moment.
Okay.
You tell me if I'm talking too much about something you don't want.
Guess what? So, just going back to your going into the Army, how did that come about?
Very easily, so far as the War Department's concerned.
Yeah.
Ready. After graduating from college, I got a letter from the Secretary of the Army. Mm-hmm. In fact, I still have it here. Asking me to join the Legion. Mm-hmm. I had taken 4 years of ROTC because my folks thought it would be good training, good experience.
Mm-hmm.
So I ended up major in the ROTC, which is interesting. Because some years later, I ended up leaving the Army as a major in field.
I read that, yeah.
And so I was called to active duty, not expecting it. And I got a letter from some general in the Air Force, which was a part of the Army at that time, mm-hmm. inviting me to come and be interviewed for the Air Force. I think it was in my third year, or maybe fourth, I don't remember. A general at the During my third or fourth year in the Army, I don't remember which, it turned out that a general at the Fort Sill Gunnery School, which was the school for the whole Army engineers and fighters and so forth. Anyway, developed a device which was a great help to the American fighters. It was known as the slide rule. And that's where it was first developed. It was very crude, but the principle was there. And it would, instead of having the regular log tables and others, it had the data for shooting the guns, for aiming the guns. And so we switched over to slide rule. Fortunately, well, first of all, I'll say unfortunately, most of the instructors had never seen a slide rule before. I'd had 3 or 4 years of the slide rule in college before I was in the Army. So I was very much in demand to explain the operation of the slide rule to various people. Interesting.
Very interesting experience in the Army. Yeah. And you said that actually the teaching was fun.
I enjoyed it.
That's very interesting. So during those war years, were you married at the time? Or
yes.
When did you get married?
Oh, that's a small thing, which I didn't think about.
Were you in college, or?
No. Yes. Oh, I remember. It's been a long time. 60 years.
Long time.
I told you my memory is not as good as it was. It was my first year in the Army. And I was at Fort North Carolina.
Okay. We can find that.
Yeah. I got a phone call late one night. I was living in the unmarried officers' quarters. Mm-hmm. We each had a room, but they were made out of very cheap wood and so forth, and you could hear everything from the other rooms. And the phone rang, and someone hollered out, this was late at night, that it was, well, it's 3 hours difference, that Golding was wanted on the phone. So I got up and went to the phone, which was in the hallway where everybody could hear it. And I said, hello, and it was Hinda's voice. And she said, oh, I'm glad I got you. And I said, well, I'm glad too. What's the matter? She said, nothing's the matter, but I'm getting tired of sitting back here waiting. And if you don't come home soon, I'm coming down there. And that's true. I had a tough decision to make. And so, I'll see if I can get leave, because I was willing to get married, too. And this is an interesting story now that I think of it. I asked for leave. This is in the fall of 41. I went in the summer of 41. After a slight delay, leave was granted for a short time. So I was overjoyed, and I called her and said I would be home on a certain date and so forth. And she was overjoyed too. She says, fine, I'll be waiting for you. And the day before I could go, and the evening of the night before I could leave. It's midnight, you know, and you can leave the next day. And I was going at midnight, too. I was all gassed up and ready to go. And it was about 10 minutes to 12. And the phone rang in the OD's office. And the officer of the day called me. I was outside there. He said, "You're wanted on the phone." I said, "No, what?" And I got on the phone, and it was the officer of the day, the big one for the camp. And he said, "Your leave has been canceled." And I said, "Why?" He said, "You haven't heard?" It was D-Day. The timing was perfect.
Oh, my. Isn't that something? That's a great story.
Yeah. And I said, "Oh, my God. I hated to call him, even if it was late at night." Well, it was 3 hours earlier. I had to tell her that, and she was fried, of course. She said, "See what you can do." Well, I managed to get to leave anyway. That's what, 3 weeks later.
Good.
And this time it wasn't canceled, but I couldn't get as long a leave as I'd hoped for. Mm-hmm. And I did the same thing and drove home without stopping from the fort to Chicago. Mm-hmm. Got in late, about midnight the next day. And it was a Thursday. And we were going to get married on Sunday. Because I had to go leave on Tuesday, which didn't give me much time. So Friday, and they said, "We've got to get blood tests." I hadn't thought about it. And I said, "Okay." I said, "Where do we go?" She said, "Go to my doctor. We'll both go and get blood tests at him." So we went to her doctor, whom I'd never met or anything, and we had our blood tests. And I said, "When will they read it and so forth?" Because I were getting married in 2 days. He said, "Oh, probably tomorrow, Saturday, at the county hospital in Chicago." Mm-hmm. So Sunday morning, and then I drove from Oak Park, where folks were living, and drove down to county hospital and walked into the building where they tested, and there were just tubes all over the counters there. There was one girl in there, one young lady, and it was empty otherwise. And there were just hundreds of bottles of test tubes around the stands. And she said, "What's on your mind?" I remember this so well, of course. And I said, "We've come to get the results of our blood tests. We're getting married tomorrow." She said, "What's your name?" I told her. She said, "No, you're not." I said, "Not what?" She says, "Getting married tomorrow." And I said, "Why not?" She says, "Look around you." She says, "They all come before you." They were there. I said, "I'm going back to active duty the day after, 2 days after. I have to get that test." She says, "I'm sorry, we do it in order." I turned to him and I said, "Boy, when we get back to Oak Park, they're going to scream." And the girl said, "Oak Park? Do you come from Oak Park?" I said, "Yes, we both do." "Oh," she says, "I live in Oak Park." She says, "Where do you live?" I said, "On Wisconsin Avenue." And she said, "Where on Wisconsin Avenue?" I said, 338. She says, "That's where I live. My folks had moved the month before. These are the people who had moved in after them."
Oh, isn't that amazing?
"What do you think the odds are?"
Oh, amazing.
She said, "Just a minute, let me look for your tubes."
Oh.
And that's how we got married that Sunday.
Oh, what a beautiful story. That's amazing. That's really great.
I'll finish that with a more unique thing.
Yeah.
When I got back to camp, finally, I got razzed by all my colleagues. Not for that reason. Because of the date. So happened that because of the date, it was December 21st. I've asked dozens of people what that significance that has, and no one has answered it. Yet you know it.
Is that winter solstice?
What does that mean?
Oh.
Come on, don't disappoint me.
I'm just trying to remember. What would you? I know it's winter solstice.
Yeah, it's an astronomical term, winter solstice.
Yeah. So what happens at winter solstice?
21st of December.
Yeah.
That's the longest night in the year.
Oh, right, right, right.
Does it penetrate?
So.
That's why I got razzed by all my colleagues.
Got it.
Got it.
Finally. I finally got it. Oh, that's wonderful.
Isn't it? So I never forget the date.
I will never forget the date now either. Oh, that's great. What a great story.
I don't think of these things, but.
That's terrific. It's a wonderful story.
One of the things that occurred during the Army, which was fruitful for me because it made me a little more humble. During my Army career, I taught a lot of, back to Fort Sill, the Army headquarters for teaching field artillery and other things. And one of the things that I taught was gunnery, of course, and courts martial and various other things. And a year or two went by, and I went back to my fort in the east and then back again to Fort Sill to teach. And I was teaching a group of enlisted men. And the guy who was taking them through, escorting them, was a captain. And when we finished, he looked at me and he said, "Don't you remember me?" And I looked at him. I thought, it can't be. I was a lieutenant, first lieutenant then. Mm-hmm. He was a captain. He said, "You taught me when I was a private."
Oh.
I still don't know how he got promoted so fast. That made me humble.
That's a good story.
It was a sad day for me.
But it sounds like you enjoyed aspects of being in the Army.
No. One of the things I enjoyed, which is another facet, is that one of the captains, when I was a captain later on, was a pilot for our group headquarters, mm-hmm. which is, group is three regiments usually. And they were going through tests and all that for going overseas, and we had to test them for gunnery, and I was the guy, because I was a gunnery officer, or second gunnery officer. And Earl Headland. And he flew those little grasshopper planes for forward observation. You know what I mean? We had airplanes attached to our group headquarters.
Okay.
And these airplanes were very light airplanes, but real airplanes.
Okay.
They used to go forward ahead of our advancing army to spy on the advancing enemy.
Okay.
They're called observation. And during the time I was there, I talked Earl into teaching me how to fly an airplane. So I did a lot of airplane flying there, which was interesting.
Yeah. Did you go on to fly after that?
No. Yes, 1 10-minute time. This is completely different.
Okay.
Years later, when I was on American Airlines jet going from San Diego to Ohio. I was on a board of a company then, and I was going there for a board meeting. Because it was company business, I could travel first class. And I had to do it every month. That's while I was president here. Mm-hmm. I usually sat in the front row of the first class seats by myself. Mm-hmm. And the captain would come in along with the other officers just before they were ready to fly, and he'd see me sitting there, and after two or three times he'd nod at me because he recognized me as coming regularly. And he stopped by my seat one day and talked to me and found out who I was and what I was doing. And he lived here in San Diego. And the next time I flew, as we got up and were flying eastward, a stewardess came up to me and said, "You're Mr. Golding, aren't you?" And I said, "Yes." And he said, "The captain wants to see you." I said, "Okay." So I got up and went forward. And he was sitting there at the seat, pilot's seat, and he said, "How would you like to fly the plane?" This was one of these big plane, passenger planes, jets. And I said, "Sure." So he got up and got the seat behind me and sat there. He said, "Do you know anything about it?" I said, "Well, I used to fly a grasshopper." He says, "You know enough." So for about 10 or 15 minutes, I flew the plane.
Terrific.
He'd have been court-martialed if anybody had known that. Plane full of passengers and high up, and I am no expert. But
what an adventure.
I kept going straight. I wasn't landing or taking off.
Well, that's...
And that was my experience with a big plane for a short time.
So in the Army, after that, how did it end for you? I mean, your next step after the Army was what? You went home?
Yes, I had a car. I drove straight home without stopping again and stopped at my in-law's house in Oak Park. My folks had moved to Chicago meanwhile. I stopped at Oak Park because my wife was there. She and their daughter. And my son, who was a baby. I skipped that part. But he was born at Fort...
And he was your firstborn.
Incidentally, you might be interested to know that my grandfather, my maternal grandfather's name was Max Brage.
Because your name is unusual.
Very unusual. And one of his six daughters was Viola Brage, my mother, naturally.
That is interesting. Because
wait a minute. And she named her firstborn Brage.
Brage.
My son is Brage, Jr. My grandson is Brage.
Oh, that's nice.
My great-grandson is Brage.
Oh, how wonderful.
So we have a dynasty going.
That's wonderful. I was wondering, because it's an interesting name and unusual.
Well, it's for Europe.
Yeah.
But that's a bunch of Brages.
A bunch of Brages. That's terrific. I think that is interesting.
Okay. I keep thinking of things that I never hadn't thought about for years.
So when your son was born, you decided to name him Brage as well. And he was born when you were still in the Army?
No. Yes, yes. He was born in the hospital, Army hospital.
Mm-hmm.
The one in North Carolina.
Right.
Why can't I think of it? I know it perfectly well. That's my problem. Anyway, my daughter was born in Muskogee, Oklahoma, Susan.
Mm-hmm. Now, what were you doing?
Oh, that's an interesting...
Yeah, let's hear.
When Susan was in college, she wanted to go to Europe and do those year in Europe, things that students do.
Junior year abroad?
That's right.
Yes.
And she had taken much French when she was here at home. And she went there, and they had a tough refresher in French. And she went to the Sorbonne. She was sent to the Sorbonne. And she studied there for a year. And I was told, I assume it's true, that when she was in her end of her first year there at the Sorbonne, she spoke such perfect French that the French people could not distinguish that she was a foreigner. And that's a real compliment.
That's lovely.
Yeah.
That is a real compliment.
She, when she was mayor, she had a guest, several guests from France here to dedicate something, and I went to it. Because I told her, I said, are you going to speak English or French? Yeah. She says, English, of course. My French is rusty. I said, speak French. I said, study up if necessary.
That's a nice thing.
And they came, and she said, mon ami, and off she went. And they looked at her, and boy, the crowd just roared.
That's marvelous. Good advice.
Yeah. Yeah. I could go on forever.
Well,
we can't, I know.
I think that it's certainly adding other dimensions of your personal
Fort
life.
Fort Bragg.
Yeah, Fort Bragg, North Carolina.
Just came.
Okay, I've heard of Fort Bragg.
It's a big fork.
Right. Now, after the Army, you went home, and then...
Went home.
What?
I got acquainted with my son, who was born at Fort Bragg.
Mm-hmm.
Susan was born, BG was born at Fort Bragg. That's his initials, we call him BG. We have to distinguish among all
yeah.
other ages.
That's cute. And then did you immediately begin to work in another university, or what happened?
No, I went back to school.
Oh, I see.
Summer session was on, and I went to University of Chicago where my folks lived, and I took two courses in chemistry, so I'd be ready. It was 4 years since I'd been in school.
Mm-hmm.
And after that, I was looking for a job, and it so happened at that time the job market was booming,
mm-hmm.
not like now.
Mm-hmm.
It was really booming. I had 18 job offers.
Mm-hmm.
I had one turned down. All the others wanted me to go. It was amazing. And the one that I tried hardest to get me to come was DuPont. This is off the record.
So where did you work?
After I got out of summer school, which was done at...
Chicago?
No. Oh, another one. That summer that I went to school at University of Chicago, I took this chemistry course, but I took another chemistry course, which was a theoretical chemistry course, which was by a man whom you will know, if I can think of his name. He's renowned worldwide.
Well,
no, it's important. I'll get it. It'll be like the fort.
Right.
He was giving lectures for advanced chemistry students.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I wasn't an advanced chemistry student. I was just starting going back after 4 years.
Right.
And Linus Pauling.
Oh, of course. Yeah.
But I thought we could learn about the nature of the atom, you know, things that happened since I was in school. And I was not a chemist. I was a chemical engineer. So I didn't have as much chemistry then as I had subsequently. And it was a big lecture hall, and there were all the chemistry students from Purdue, graduate students. I wasn't a graduate student then. So after sitting through two or three lectures, I turned to the guy next to me, whom I hadn't talked to before, as the session ended, and said, "My God, do you make any sense out of this? I don't understand a word of what he's saying." And just then, he turned to the guy on his side and said, "Isn't this wonderful? He makes everything crystal clear." And true. I didn't say a word to him. That's what I was going to say. The first company I went to work for then, I didn't take the other job.
Right.
And the first company I went to work for was the one who had supported me on my fellowship.
Oh.
I felt somewhat of an obligation.
And that company was Lilly?
Lilly Industrial Coatings.
And what did you do there?
That's what's interesting. They're in Indianapolis, and they had two other plants around the country. And they make only industrial coatings. That's coatings for furniture, chairs, cabinets, tables, not house paint. It's a very specific industry and very difficult because it has very specific requirements. Right color has to be exactly right, the shade, the strength of it. Demanding
mm-hmm.
industry.
Mm-hmm.
And I worked for them for 11 years. And during the time I worked for them, I was advanced eventually to director of research for the company. And wrote my book.
About resins?
About what?
Polymers, resins. Yeah.
Turn that off.
Okay.
John, while I was working at Lilly, they hired me not to work at Lilly, but to work at Purdue.
Mm-hmm.
They entered into a negotiation with the Purdue Foundation to lease a couple of laboratories in the Chem Engineering Building where I spent my time as a student. And I was to be in charge, and we were supposed to work on new things for the coatings industry. I mean, different kinds of matter, different kinds of paints or whatever, or coatings.
Mm-hmm.
And they entered into a long-term agreement. And I stayed there for 6 or 7 years. So I had the best of all worlds because I got this kind of research I wanted to do in an academic environment at industrial pay.
And tell me about the book you wrote.
Well, that was an outcome of my working at Lilly and being in academe. Not finding a book that was the thing. I wrote several pages of notes for the first time I taught the course.
Mm-hmm.
And I looked at the notes after the first time and said, "This should be a book." So I decided to write a book.
Today is Thursday, April 27th, 2006. This is Susan Resnick, back with Dr. Brage Golding for our second interview session. Good morning, Dr. Golding.
Good morning, says Susan.
Let's continue discussing your professional development. You were at Purdue and also working in industry.
This is tape three. Numbering the size.
Mm-hmm.
I was at Purdue for 5 years as head of the School of Chemical Engineering. and it was probably my most enjoyable time.
What was particularly enjoyable about it?
Well, I was under the dean of engineering, as all the other heads of engineering schools were, and I happened to buy a house next door to him, and it was he was a good man, and I enjoyed visiting with him off the record. I mean,
yes,
Nick, as a neighbor.
Yes,
I used to fix things for him and others. That's a point I might mention, and that is when I got back from Army duty and moved to Lafayette, Indiana, mm-hmm. where Purdue is, I had three, I think, old little radios which weren't working mm-hmm. that I brought back with me, and I took them to a shop downtown where they had radio stores in Lafayette. And I got them all back, and in a month, none of them worked again. And I'm a chemical engineer, not an electrical engineer. But I was annoyed, and I said, it can't be that complicated. So I went to the electrical engineering school building and checked out some books on radio and read them and fixed my radios. They worked. The interesting thing about it is that my students, who were in the same place I was, and other faculty members, saw these radios when I brought them back, and said, "What are they here for?" I just repaired them and so forth. They said, "You fix radios?" And I said, "Yes. Would you look at mine?" And in a little while, I used to go home at night from the building and find two or three radios in the back seat of my car. I didn't lock it. I had no idea who they came from.
Oh, that's interesting.
They're just there. And so I'd take them home, and my pleasure was fixing radios and amplifiers.
And I'm sure they appreciated it, too.
Eventually, television. And I had fun at night fixing them. And after a while, I'd get a phone call saying, "This is so-and-so on the campus. I left a radio with you." "It's like this," he described it to me. "Did you do anything?" I said, "Yeah, it's ready." And he came over and picked up the radio. I only charged him for parts, not for labor. And I built up quite a collection of parts by replacing what I used.
So you had a whole other
hobby.
Hobby going there.
Yes.
Yeah.
The trouble was that after about a year of this, I started getting complaints from the radio shops downtown.
Oh, funny.
I was taking their business away, and I hadn't given it a thought.
Oh, that's funny.
Yeah. So I had to stop eventually just to keep peace. But that was another hobby.
That's really a great story. So I'm sure that added another dimension to your life during those years.
Well, I got a good electrical engineering education by reading the books and fixing things. And it wasn't very difficult either.
If you have that ability.
Yeah, well, I'm an engineer by choice, and I can fix almost anything.
That's great.
Mechanical, electrical. I used to spend my life fixing things in households for friends and relatives.
Nice.
I would go to my aunt's, and she'd say, "Oh, I'm glad to see you." She was in Chicago. We were in Oak Park.
Right.
And she'd say, "I've got this orange juice squeezer or something like that that isn't working. Can you fix it?" And so I said, "Give it to me." And I've done that the rest of my life.
So it seems like you're a fixer-upper of a lot of things, apparently universities as well.
That leads to an interesting statement that I can make, and that is I'm not the type of academic who delves deeply into some personage in 1600 who wrote a poem or something like that. Mm-hmm. I leave that to the professional English teachers. Mm-hmm. but I am a fixer-upper. And not only can I fix most electrical and mechanical things, but I fix universities.
And that is what's needed, clearly. And that takes
Most of the presidents don't have that knack.
Well,
university presidents.
It's a very special knack.
Yes, it is.
And tell me how you went from Purdue to Wright State, and you not only fixed it up, I believe you created it.
That's right.
Tell me about that.
Well, I was at Purdue as head of the School of Chemical Engineering for 5 years and had no intention of leaving. And I got a phone call one day, and it was a doctor so-and-so from a big company in Dayton, Ohio.
Mm-hmm.
And he said he was the chairman of a committee searching for a president for a new university to be built in Dayton, Ohio. And my name had come up, and he wanted to know if I would be interested. I hadn't given it a thought before that. And I said, I don't know, but I'd be willing to talk to you about it. Well, he says another person and I would like to come over and visit with you some Saturday morning when school's not busy. I said, so we made a date, and these two gentlemen came over. One was the head of Monsanto, a division of Monsanto in mm-hmm. Dayton, and the other one was the chief, what's the word I want? Chief technical person
mm-hmm.
at Wright-Patterson Air Base, which was across the street from where they were. That's a top man.
Yes.
A top technical man at the Wright-Patterson Air Force Base.
Huh.
And I remember sitting in my office there, and these two men came in, and we sat and talked for an hour or two. And they said they were citizens interested in what was going on in San Diego, in Dayton.
About what year was this, do you recall? It was after World War II. Well, we can always look that up.
I'd say about 72.
I think prior to that, because 72 was when you came to
here,
San Diego State. Yeah, so it had to be sometime, maybe in the 60s.
Oh, 66.
Okay.
66. I'm one university off.
Right. Well, there are so many. Okay.
That's right. And it was a pleasant talk. And I said, how far have you gotten with the university you're talking about? And they mm-hmm. said, well, we don't have it yet. We're going to take up a collection from the community and buy some land and start a university. Well, that was a fixer-upper. That's what got me. Oh, yes. I'm starting to think of other things again. Anyway, they said that the governor had formed a committee to do this, forming a university. There was no public university in that corner of Ohio.
Mm-hmm.
There were three other state universities in Ohio at that time. In the other three corners of the state, roughly a square. And they wanted one over there. It was near to Miami University of Ohio,
mm-hmm.
which of course was much smaller than they contemplated.
Mm-hmm.
So I found out that the man who was going to be chairman of this committee to search for first president was the CEO and president of NCR, National Cash Register,
mm-hmm.
which had its headquarters and other factories there in Dayton. It's a very large company.
Mm-hmm.
It still is. And they were just converting at that time from mechanical computers and calculators, the old-fashioned
yes.
kind, to this new thing which had transistors in them, electrical,
yeah.
mechanical.
Yeah.
And the head of all of NCR was this man, and he's the one that had sent these two others on the board to see me. They thanked me and left. And for several months, I heard nothing. And my son's graduation, his PhD at MIT, came up, and my wife and I went to the East to be present at his commencement. By this time, he was married. And after the commencement, we were sitting around his apartment on the campus of MIT, and the phone rang, and my son went to it, Grace Jr.
Yes.
And he said, "Dad, it's for you." And I said, "Nobody knows I'm here, except my family." Mm-hmm. So I answered the phone and said, "This is Bob Oldman, the head of NCR, O-E-L-M-A-N. And we have interviewed, I don't remember how many. I was the first, it turned out, they interviewed.
I
didn't think, that's one of the reasons I didn't think I'd hear from him again.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, "We've gone through several candidates, and you have come out on top." And that he wanted me to come to Dayton right away. And I said, "Do you know where I am?" He said, "No." I said, "How did you find me?" He says, "We have ways of finding out." That was early on. Now everybody knows everything.
Yes.
And I said, I don't think I can right away because it's a time when my family's going camping out in the Rockies, which we do every summer.
That's great.
Outdoor camping. It's tent camping, not trailers. And we go to we went to the Rockies, up and down from Albuquerque up to Canada. And we loved it. My wife loved it. The kids loved it.
What a wonderful way to be together as a family.
Yeah, it's great.
So you told them you were not able to go right away.
I was not able to go right away. He said, "You must come now." And I said, "I can't. I'm going camping." And I said, "Why do you want me to come?" He said, "Well, we want to talk to you about this presidency." And that's the first time I'd heard from him in months. I had no idea. And I said, "I'm sorry, but I can't give up this camping. It's too important for my family." And he said, grudgingly, "All right, we'll wait until you get back."
That's great. And I like that story because it reflects your values that the family came first. Yeah.
So we went camping. And all the while we were camping, we knew that there was a possibility now of my being selected, which I hadn't expected either. As the first candidate to be interviewed, I thought they'd have forgotten about me by that time. So after going camping, we discussed this thing all the time while we were camping, of course, and lay over everything. And I was happy where I was at Purdue as head of the school of chemical engineering. So I called Mr. Oldman, and he says, "Wonderful." He says, "Well, let's get together, the whole board and you, such and such a day, and I'll send my plane for you." That's when I first got introduced to civilian planes. And the plane did come. You wouldn't know that Purdue has an airport where Amelia Earhart was based.
Oh. I certainly know of Amelia Earhart.
Yes,
I know that's where she was based.
Yes. Purdue taught aeronautics and aeronautical engineering. And there was, I think, one of the first airports at a university. So I didn't object to their sending an airplane for me. And I went and met with this group of men. And the first thing I noticed when I was introduced was who they were. It was a dazzling array. Mm-hmm. I won't think of all the names of them right now, but I could get it if you ever wanted to. But,
okay.
But Oldman was the CEO of NCR. John, just put John down, I can't think of his last name right now, was the chief scientist at Wright-Patterson Air Force Base across the highway. The head of, the head of the third biggest newspaper chain in the country, who's headquartered there too, in Dayton.
I don't know offhand.
Cox.
I think
it was Cox.
So this was quite an illustrious
group.
Yeah.
Gene Kettering. Do you know who he is?
No.
He's the one, he and his father invented the electric starter for automobiles. We wouldn't have automobiles.
Oh, my.
He's an inventor and very famous in technical circles.
Yeah. Oh, my.
And
quite a group.
And the chief lawyer in Dayton, one of the head lawyers. And CEO of Armco Steel. There are more, and I can't think of their names right now.
Okay.
But it was an august group.
Wow, yes.
And I thought, boy, this must be important. Anyway, we sat down and talked, and they said that I was their first choice. But it was up to me, of course. And they wanted to tell me exactly what it was and what they had in mind. And these were men who were all in the area, but had a very strong feeling toward doing things for the community. And new university there would be one thing that they badly needed, because it was just after the veterans were coming back from the war.
Mm-hmm.
And with that bill that gave money to go to school, I was one of them, as a matter of fact. And they were looking to start a new public university in Dayton. And they wanted it to be technically oriented, because Wright-Patterson Air Force Base, the Air Force main base in the country,
mm-hmm.
lay across the road. And they said they had already decided to name it Wright University, Wright State University, because there was the first one killed in the war and across in Europe, whose name was Wright.
Mm.
And he came from Wright-Patterson Air Force Base.
Mm.
And they were going to call it Wright State University, and I looked at him and I said, I have a better name for it. And they looked at me. And they said, what? And I said, put a the in front of it. The Wright State.
The Wright State University.
They didn't do it.
Right.
But I thought I was half joking.
Yeah.
So they made me an offer, and I said, I can't make a decision now. I have to talk to my family.
Mm-hmm.
They said, well, we really want you because you have a technical background. I said, what have you done so far? They said, we have bought a farm outside of Dayton.
Oh, my.
Big field.
That was it? That's all they've done?
No, and we have given them the money. Well, they hired a businessman, an older man, Fred. I have all this information if it's important.
Sure, we can always add that.
Yeah. Purchased the land. Mm-hmm. It was secret. They didn't tell anybody what they were doing. Well, the prices would go up. It's the old story. And we have just almost finished the first building on that land.
Huh.
I said, the first building? You don't have a university. No, we don't have it yet. We just started. Well, I was kind of dubious then. And I said, we'd like you to, if you were willing, we'd like you to bring your wife back with you the next time you come, and we'll show you the land and the building. So they did, and I did. And Enda came back with me. And we had the usual dinner and all that sort of stuff. They were working on me pretty hard. And they took me out to the field, and it was just a bare cornfield. Big one, but nothing on it except one relatively small building. And it was nothing around it. And Hinda leaned over to me as we walked over the land. She said, let's go.
Oh.
I said, well, let's see it. So we went to the building, and they were very proud of it. It was a lovely building. We walked through it, and this is the first all-purpose building I've ever seen for an academic institution. It had everything in it. One building, not a big one. It had classrooms, the usual registrar, and all the others, faculty rooms, cafeteria, a few books, and so forth. And it was just a skeleton of a university.
Mm-hmm.
And so we said we'd go home and talk about it, think about it. And on the way back, they flew us back. Enda said, that's nothing. You've got a better job now. Mm-hmm. And I said, that's not the issue. I said, it's something that's different. And I'm an entrepreneur, sort of. And putting together a new university would be delightful to me.
The challenge.
Yeah, I like challenges. And incidentally, this is why I went to these other schools afterwards, because they were all in need of help.
Mm-hmm.
So we talked about it some more. And finally decided, I persuaded my wife to say, let's take a chance. I've been here at Purdue 5 years. I enjoy it. I like it. It has everything. It's a big university.
Yeah.
And this gives me a chance to go somewhere else. I feel like I want to. I said, I've been in industry for 11 years, and I've been at Purdue for 6 years. And this is a chance to start from scratch. It'll be hard work, I'm sure. So,
I think that's very exciting.
Well, you haven't heard most of it. This is where I'm getting into something interesting to me.
Mm-hmm.
The board, when I got there, had rented a house for me in a suburb of Dayton. And they said, we're going to build you a house on the campus if you want. I said, that would be nice. I want to be on campus, not off campus.
Mm-hmm.
And they told me that I could have what I wanted. And I turned to them and said, my wife is very good at this sort of thing. If you have a committee or something about building a house, she must be a member of the committee.
terrific.
They had no objection to that. And she's good. She was good. And so they rented a house out in the suburbs, which was small but nice. And they said, well, this isn't adequate for you. We'll rent you a house in Dayton, or in the big part of Dayton. And so they persuaded a townsperson to give up his house. And it was a magnificent house in the nice part of Dayton. So that part was taken care of. They said, we've also made an agreement with the Ohio State University, and that does have a "the" in front of it, officially, for you to be, during your time, till things get started in the university, you will be a vice president of the Ohio State University and a vice president of Miami University. So you'll have some status, as well as president-to-be of Wright State University. So when it turned out that everybody heard about it, and also I still retained my head of the school of chemical engineering at Purdue University. So I think I was unique in having four jobs at the same time with approval.
Yes.
But what they didn't think about was what a load it put on me, because I had to plan a new university, and I had to be present at the meetings of the other two universities and disengage myself and my work and everything and sell a house and everything at Purdue University.
Sounds like a very busy time.
And I had to hire all the people for the new university too at that time. It was a big job. I grew up fast. It was a very good thing for me because I had to learn fast.
Mm-hmm.
And I interviewed dozens and dozens of people, vice presidents, deans, faculty, janitors even. It was something. And they said, we happen to be very friendly with the governor. These were the top people in the state. Now, I knew they were very friendly with the governor. They said, we'll get you some money to start building. And I said, how many students are you expecting?
Mm-hmm.
And they said, quite a few, because all these veterans are coming back from the war. And I said, fine. And so I spent most of my time there going at the university, aside from all those things I just mentioned, going over building plans and seeing buildings built and walking over the foundations and stuff. It was...
That's very interesting. And with your background, I'm sure... Yeah,
but it was in addition to all the other stuff. And I had to pick out a place to put a house, and that land there was very pretty. And it had a large copse of woods in the middle of it. And almost all the trees.
A lot of pine trees, or what kind?
That's what I'm trying to think of.
Yeah. I'm trying to think of that part. I've been to Ohio.
Walnut.
Oh, walnut trees. Oh,
walnut
nice.
Trees.
That sounds absolutely beautiful. So there were lovely walnut trees on this piece of land.
And walnut trees are a disappearing species. And as I would fast forward now to say that they're very valuable, very expensive when you get something made out of straight walnut. In furniture, for example, or in veneers. That wasn't my thought at that time, but there's a sequence to that.
Mm-hmm.
And I found a knoll with a drop in the woods down to a stream below, entirely surrounded by trees.
Mm.
And I said, that's where the house should be.
Oh, how nice.
And they agreed. And we looked for a architect. And agreed. Now, this was a long time ago. They agreed that they'd fund it, not state money. They couldn't do that. Mm-hmm. So these big magnates turned to each other at the meeting and said, Bob, you put in $50,000 and you put in $100,000 and I'll put in $500,000 from their businesses. Mm-hmm. They were rich men.
Mm-hmm.
The governor picked them deliberately as well-to-do financiers to get us money for the school. And I was not unhappy with that.
Mm-hmm.
So they raised somewhere between $500,000 and $700,000 per house. At that time, it was a lot of money.
Yes.
And it was a beautiful house when it was built. They searched for an architect, and Hinda and I said, we know of an architect. We've never met him. But he's reputed to be one of the best in the country. And they said, who is it? And I told him, can't think of the name now.
Mm-hmm.
But he's still architecting.
Mm-hmm.
And he's good. He's very famous. And I just can't remember the name. But he's in the East. And they said, that's all right. You know, if he's that good, we'd like something like that. So we got hold of him, and he expressed interest. And we put the plan before the state architect, who has to pass on all architecture.
Mm-hmm.
And he turned it down. These are one of the little stones in the road to something
mm-hmm.
or other.
Mm-hmm.
And the reason was a specious one. He says, we want Ohio architects for an Ohio house. I said, this guy is world famous. He said, we're in Ohio. That buttresses your comment earlier.
Mm-hmm.
And we want to use our own people.
Mm.
So we had to go look for another one, and we did. And he was very good. He was from Cincinnati. And he built the house. But Hendo was with him all the time. And it was some house. You would gasp if you had seen it.
Maybe, do you have any pictures sometime we could see?
If I could find it.
Yeah. Well, it sounds like it must have been magnificent.
It was. I can visualize it. It was lovely. I'll tell you off the record later some of the things it had, but we'll go on. And anyway, we finally moved in there. They furnished it, incidentally, too. This was a nice bunch of men to have on one's board.
Mm-hmm.
And they were all men, come to think of it.
Mm.
That was the governor.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the way Wright State started.
That was the genesis, huh?
That was the genesis.
And then, what kind of students did you attract?
All kinds. That's another story. What I wanted to say was, the governor called a meeting of the presidents of all the state schools in Columbus, and we had lunch with them. It was just happened. He did that one day, feeling like it'd be nice to meet these presidents. The governor was not an academic person.
Mm-hmm.
And so we went over to Columbus, suburb of Columbus, where the governor's mansion was, and had a nice lunch with him. And after lunch, he leaned back and like this, you know, and said, well, boys, he said, the state is in pretty good shape right now. He says, I'm tempted to give each of you a building. I'll go around the room and you tell me what you want. And he did. I was the junior member then because I'd just come. And he said, what building do you want, Bridge? And I said, a library. He looked at me and he said, no. And I looked at him and I said, why not?
Mm-hmm.
He says, it won't be easy to fund something like a library. Swimming pool, a meeting place, something like that. Hmm. I said, Governor, I said, did you ever hear of a school without a library? And he looked at me, blank look on his face, and he finally said, okay.
That's a wonderful story.
That's the way it happened.
Oh, that's
wonderful. Off the top of my head, a library. And to finish that story, they asked me what design I wanted for the library. And I said, I want a triangular library. And he said, triangular? I never heard of a triangular except the Flatiron in New York.
Mm-hmm.
I said, I want it to be unique, particularly for stodgy Midwest. And I got it. They built a triangular library.
Oh.
It's quite a place.
It must be.
Yeah. It's been expanded since then. Anyway, that's in a sense a side issue. I just wanted you to know how it started.
I think that's very interesting because, of course, this is building towards your coming to San Diego State, the kind of experience that you must have had in just having to do everything.
Yeah, I did everything. Everything.
Wow. And how long were you there?
I was at Rice State 5 years, I think. And during that time, we built several buildings.
Mm-hmm.
Several. Which kept me busy, as I said earlier.
Mm-hmm.
Going over plans, walking the foundations, talking with him and talking with me about what we wanted in the house and everything. It was a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity to get something we wanted.
Mm-hmm.
And we didn't have to pay for it.
Mm-hmm. And so it was a very unique experience.
Absolutely. I don't know of another case like that.
Yeah. And so you were creating a university while you were at Wright State University. It's sounding like there were so many positive experiences and you had this challenge